The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of ImproMafia. Meaning, if you've got a problem, email Dan, not Wade.
ImproMafia presents And Time!
Welcome to And Time, a podcast for improvisers and aspiring improvisers. I'm Dan Beeston, ImproMafia's resident tech guy and designer.
And I'm Natalie Bohensky. I'm an ImproMafia player and I'm also, according to Dan, the marketing guru, which is a very nice title.
What's been going on in the world of impro? Well, we had another grudge match comedy theatre show recently.
Yes, you did. It was the night of August the 10th, which was the night I was flying back into the country. So I think I landed just as the show was nearing its conclusion.
Yeah. We could have done with you too, because
oh really?
Wade decided that rather than organise the show 2 weeks in advance, that he would start thinking about organising it on the Saturday afternoon before the Sunday night show.
Well, to be fair, that sounds... I'm not in the business of bagging Wade. The festival is, from what I hear, because I missed the festival.
Yeah, perfectly timed as always.
Yeah, well,
I booked the biggest impro festival
I did.
Of Brisbane's history.
That's right. But I had booked my holiday first. So I blame ImproMafia, which I'm a part of, for booking the festival at that time. They should have picked another date, quite frankly. But I was very sad to miss it. But from what I understand, it was massive and everyone enjoyed themselves and everyone had a good time and everyone was absolutely exhausted once it was over because it was so intense for three days.
Yeah.
So I think that Wade can be given some leniency in not necessarily.
Someone needs to be snapping at his heels, getting things in order.
That's a bit harsh.
But at any rate, oh well.
Yes.
Because you weren't here.
Because I wasn't here.
We were down on players.
Right.
And because Wade organised it on the last day,
Why are you bagging Wade?
I'm not bagging it. This is the truth.
So the caveat you put at the start of the program, the on-time podcast.
Someone else called it that the other day too.
A podcast.
And considering...
It's on time. The And Time podcast where you say, if you've got a problem, email Dan, not Wade. Who would Wade email?
He'd email Dan, not Wade.
Yeah, he wouldn't email himself.
See, I can't. If I've got a problem with the podcast, I can only email myself.
You can only email
And I rarely listen to myself, as is obvious from the things that I say in the podcast.
So you only had two players per side.
We had two players per side.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting.
It was interesting. It was actually really fun.
Oh, good.
It was a really fun way of doing it because everyone was always ready to jump on stage because they knew that they were probably going to be needed. Whereas if you've got three people on stage, people can sort of take a break and go, oh, I'm not really listening to this next scene. But yeah, we were all on top of our game for the entire way through. So it was exhausting, but our energy levels stayed up as well.
Good. And so. How was the crowd? How was the audience?
Good. Quite a big crowd, actually.
Excellent. Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
I understand that you may have had some children in the audience. How did that...
Oh, yeah.
How did that go? Because impro is not... I don't think it's child unfriendly, but there's certainly sometimes themes and concepts that we discuss.
You can never know what's going to be said or what you're going to say. And I remember back when we started, we had to keep the show PG rated when we were doing it with Kubler-Auckland. But I always found that censoring myself got in the way of just doing the game and being invested in the character and doing what I want to do. And in a couple of times since where I've had to censor myself, I've played like crap. Like, all I've got is my dick jokes.
I disagree. Is it just because you're thinking about it too much? I mean, if I swear a lot in life. I really do. Someone gave me the nickname once of Trooper because I do have quite a filthy, filthy mouth. But when I'm on stage, I don't swear that much. And I think it's just a natural barrier that steps in.
Mm.
Maybe it's also because I work on radio. So
you know
that you just don't say nasty words because you can get in a lot of trouble. So I've got no problem with swearing in impro, but I think if there are kids present and I knew I'll probably lay off the swearing, I would lay off the swearing. So, and it's not a massive issue.
I know that everyone was a bit anxious when they discovered just how young these kids, because there were 8-year-olds in the audience, basically.
The thing is, though, I think that there's a huge potential for ImproMafia to develop shows that are good fun for kids, because I think you can't really take kids to stand-up comedy. So a lot of kids don't like... theatre. I mean, they're like theatre for children. But improv, I think, has a real potential to be something that kids will like and enjoy. It's funny, it's made up, it's spontaneous, which is what kids do. They play fun, and they make up characters and they make up stories. Essentially, what we all are as improvisers our children. We are just reliving that time when we would gloriously run around the backyard pretending to be pirates or ninjas. So,
and swearing.
But so
then you get up in front of their parents, and then it's like getting up in front of your own parents.
I think you're right. I think the concern is not so much that the kids will be scarred for life, but that the parents will feel all indignant and worried that their kids will be scarred. I think that from what I heard from Greg, he did a scene where he ended it by swearing and saying the F word, but he was then punished with the bag on his head.
Yep.
So, yeah, so that's true. I got that right.
I think so.
Yeah.
He certainly ended up with the bag on his head at some point.
So the idea is that, oh, you say something naughty and you'll be punished. So the kids see that lesson of, oh, they said something naughty, which was, you know, very naughty, but they got punished for it. So they didn't get away scot-free, which is how the human brain works. If you do something bad, you get your comeuppance.
Mm.
So they got to have that naughty little, you know, laugh at, oh, the bad man said a bad word. Oh, the funny man said a bad word. But their parents felt relieved because the funny man who said a bad word was punished. So I think, and also I think kids...
It was nice to have that back up there because I knew that if I sat there and went, oh, there are kids in the audience, I'm going to have to change my play style. I would have been crap. So I just went, you know what? I'm just going to offend as many children as possible.
And did you? Did you get any written complaints? Did they email Dan, not Wade?
No, I said shit, but it was in context.
Well, yeah, as long as it's in context, of course. Yeah, I think kids... a bit more resilient than we probably give them
credit for. They're just words.
And they just go over the top of their head. And they don't get subtext. I was talking about a similar thing to a friend recently. There's a song out at the moment by a girl called Katy Perry, and it's called I Kissed a Girl. And it's basically just a big song about how she, I kissed a girl and I liked it. And I hope my boyfriend doesn't mind. And
I've heard that song. It's lame.
It's really vapid.
There was another song called I Kissed a Girl. Like,
isn't that
a decade ago? Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a great song.
It was. But this one is just playing into the kind of trend at the moment where if you are a really hot girl and you like another really hot girl, then that's really hot. But it's not... I think it's doing a bit of disservice to lesbianism because it's really representing a very stereotypical, idealized version of lesbians.
Very
it's like
shallow notion
really,
of what lesbianism
yeah,
is.
Yeah, it's like the idea that you just have a snog and touch the boobies of another girl and, oh my God, I think I might have lesbian tendencies. Men now think I'm really hot. That's what it feels like to me. It's like playing into
Isn't
that...
Isn't it called college lesbianism?
Or lipstick like lesbianism.
That lesbianism that occurs between the age of 17 and 19.
When you're exploring yourself.
Yeah.
And the thing is that I kind of got offended by this song initially because I thought, you know, I've got a 12-year-old cousin who's going to listen to this and she's going to think that, you know, if she kisses another girl, you know, ooh, men might, you know, men will like me or boys will like me. But then I realised that...
She'd be right.
Well, yeah. But I realised too that for a lot of kids, they probably just don't get those subtexts to it because when I was 12, my parents bought me Madonna's album Erotica, which accompanied the sex book. Now, I didn't get the sex book, but they bought me the album Erotica, and the song Erotica is like, erotic, erotic, put your hands all over my body. And so I was a 12-year-old running around doing raunchy dances to erotic, erotic, put your hands all over my body. And I just had no idea. I wasn't sort of wandering around going, ooh, boys will like me now. I was just going, I like Madonna, and I'm going to dance. So maybe I was just stupid, but I think that sometimes kids we...
200 million Madonna fans can't be wrong.
That's right.
But they're probably gay.
Not all of them.
Some of them are women.
Exactly. Some of them are straight women. So I think, yes, we've gone off topic, but I think in terms of kids watching impro...
Topic?
Yeah, we're talking about kids and impro. I think that kids either A, not going to get all the subtext, or B, if they do, not really care about it because they're too busy looking at the funny people or the dancing girls or whatever.
The biggest problem, though, was that there were a couple of teenagers there, too. They got into that swing of giving offers and then just kept jumping in and giving the only offers.
Oh, really?
And the offers weren't too bad, but they were all coming from the same people.
Oh, really?
So you're like, And in fact, one person called out a really nice offer. They were like, oh, that's great. And then one of the teenagers called out their offers and the MC said, oh, well, it'll be this and maybe it'll be the meaning of life, which was this kid's thing as well. Maybe it'll involve both. And I'm like, no, forget that. The hell with that. He was too late. And there was this really weird moment in the audience where it's like, were you just yelling at a kid and telling him that his ideas suck? So luckily I managed to save myself by saying there would be absolutely no meaning of anything in this at all. And then the audience was like, and then I looked quizzical and realised what I'd said. And the audience went,
I see.
No meaning. He's going
to
stop.
You really have not yet managed to stop being completely clueless, have you, Dan? In all the years I've known you.
I think it's important to take these risks.
Yeah, well, you can justify it by saying that if you want, but...
It is important to fail. It is important to fail at least twice in any show.
It's important to really pick on kids. That's what you're saying.
I don't like kids.
Yeah, get that feeling. You like to insult them in improv shows.
Yeah.
Ah, they deserve it. with their PSPs and MP3s and DVDs and
STDs.
Emo haircuts. I was at the Ecker the other week, and my God, the haircuts. You know when you really feel old is when you look at a bunch of 16-year-olds and go, what are you thinking? Why would you get your hair cut like a woman when you're a young man?
Yeah, but I look back at myself when I was that age and I go, what were you thinking?
See,
Why would you grow your hair long and get it done in dreads like that?
Yeah, you weren't that young when you did that. You weren't a teenager.
Yeah, still hadn't grown up.
Well, that's true for all of us, I think. But teenagers, what's with them? If you're listening and you're a teenager, call in. Tell us what's with you.
And quite aptly, you'll realise this podcast is in mono.
They don't know what that is. When kids ask me, I say I work in radio and I tell them the station I work on and they go... I've never heard of that. And you say it's AM, and they say, what's AM?
There's still a switch on radios these days.
Yeah,
there
still is.
Sell the switch.
If you get a phone or if you get an MP3 player that has a built-in radio, it's never AM.
Oh, it's just
only
an FM receiver,
yeah. Or they either say, you know, I've never heard of AM, or I've never listened to AM, or, oh, my parents occasionally listen to that. Hooray.
Oh, just you can listen to AM. You could build yourself a crystal set. And pick up my radio show.
So, yeah, Grudge Match, another success. And we got another one coming up on the 14th of September.
Yep.
Book now. I hear it's going to be really awesome.
You don't have to book.
No, you don't have to. But we've been getting a lot of people who've been booking through Stage Door.
Yeah.
Which is incredibly good.
It certainly makes us a bit calmer before the show if you book.
Yeah.
Please book.
It's really brilliant. You know, you turn up and they say, oh, we've got 20 bookings. And you go, oh, my God, that's just people who are already going to come. That's not counting the people who might come.
Yeah.
It's exciting. So, and then after that, we've got The Wake of Simon Chesterfield at the Brisbane Arts Theatre.
First long form that Impro Mafia has ever done officially.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well...
As Impro Mafia?
The originals, the people from Impro Mafia have done a couple of long forms down at Satchmo's.
Yeah.
Down in the wet room where...
Old school.
It would rain and the audience and the players would get wet.
And the electrics would also get wet.
Yes, so we weren't allowed to have a lighting rig on some nights. And it's not like it would just get wet and run off. It would pull down the staging.
Yeah.
So you could stand on the stage, but then when you went behind the curtain on either side, you had to stand on a chair because the chair was 3 inches deep in water.
And there was only ever room for two chairs on either side, which is why you could only ever have sort of a maximum of five people playing. So, you know, you might have two or three people on stage and the other people could be off stage sitting or standing on chairs. And then you'd all swap or all go on stage.
But it should be interesting. I haven't decided whether I want to try out for it yet.
Really?
Or not. Yeah.
I would have thought you'd be mad keen.
Well, I've never seen one, and I don't want to...
You've never seen a long form?
I've never seen The Wake.
Well, no, neither have I, but, you know, I'm still going to be there. I'm still going to be there with bells on, just giving it my impro all. Just rocking it in the real world. Because it's important to... As you say, you were just talking about how it's important to take risks and fail, and now you're saying, well... I don't really want to look like an idiot if I get this wrong, so I'm just going to stand back. You have just totally proved yourself a hypocrite.
I know that Wade really Daniel wants people Beeston. Who are really excited to be involved in it, and I'm trying to decide whether I'm excited enough to meet his expectations.
Oh, of course you are. Don't be silly.
Oh, I don't know. Been a bit sort of,
You have been?
The last couple of months.
Really? About improv in general?
Just, I've played, and then at the end of the night, even if I feel that I've done quite well, I'll come off and be like, oh, well, just another improv show.
Really?
I haven't been coming off and going, yeah!
Why do you think that is?
Other players? Co-players. Fuckers. They're not meeting my expectations.
Really?
They're supposed to be making me look better.
Right. I see. Is that why you suggested that if we do get Deborah Frances White out to do a workshop, that we do it on how to make your fellow players look better?
How to make Dan look better.
How to make Dan look better.
Yeah.
The thing is that, Dan, to make you look better is we need to sink to such depraved depths that as players, I don't know if we can with good conscience do that.
I'm always surprised to hear
that
that's
the... No, we have to subjugate ourselves and really take out our moral standings in order to make you look better.
I'm very surprised that that's the view that people have of me, is that I'm the one who sinks to these depths, because I never feel like I'm doing that on stage. I always just feel like I'm doing going naturally with the story, going where it needs to go.
Yeah, I know.
And then people go, oh, I can't believe you went there, Dan. Oh, well, I suppose child rape doesn't... But it seemed natural in the progression of the story.
Child rape. It always seems natural. But it's not kids. It's not. Call kids help.
Natalie Bohensky, our marketing guru.
I just made you look better. You see, I just proved that. cut that bit out. Natalie Bohensky is going to be taken out of context on issues involving children. Oh, no. So anyway, yeah.
So
I'm sorry you're not being excited by Impro, because I've come back from my trip just uber excited, and I can't wait to play again. And if I'd have gotten back any earlier on that Sunday, I would have turned up to Stage Door and just gone on stage, even though I'd been in a plane and not traveling for 36 hours, no showering, brushed my teeth once. I would have gone there. I would have totally gotten up stage and just gone, right, because I've been inspired by my time in Edinburgh. And it was only a week and it's over now. The Edinburgh Festival finished yesterday.
Oh, well, why don't you tell us a bit about it?
Well, Dan.
Oh, thank God we finally got onto our second subject.
Thanks for asking.
Second official subject. Sixth subject in total.
Look, by the time you can just cut all of that other stuff out, will be roses. So I went to Edinburgh on the final week of my trip overseas, ostensibly, actually, to hook up with Deborah Frances White, who is the artistic director and co-founder of the Spontaneity Shop, a London improvisation company.
I am not sure that's true. I heard that your primary reason for going over there was to see David Tennant, a.k.a. the sexiest Doctor Who of all time.
Look, that's true. That was the main catalyst for the holiday itself. But when I realised that the timing joined up with Edinburgh, the first week of the Edinburgh Fringe, I made the decision to stay on and make it a big creative...
I don't
think
David Tennant has anything to do with Impro at all.
Well,
you turncoat.
No, that's not true. He would often have to rely, I assume...
Do you reckon he does Impro?
Improvise... I don't know. I don't know if he would. He'd be good. He's very charismatic.
Mm.
He's very personable. Mm. Too skinny, though. Really very skinny.
See, that's what Aurelie says. I said he's like, you know, sexy Doctor Who. And she's like, oh, no, David Tennant's not sexy.
He's kind very of cute.
Quirky and skinny and weird looking.
I think he's really attractive just because of his, you know, his persona that he puts on as the Doctor. I find that very attractive and very fun.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I couldn't date the man because, you know, he's really ringing me up every day going, come on, Natalie, how about it? And I'm just saying,
Sorry, David,
you're just too skinny, because he'd be like 20 kilos lighter than I am. And that's, you know... I'm sorry to admit it, but he'd be like, I'm not going to say what I think he'd be like because I don't want to give away my horrendous weight, but he's just too skinny. Can you imagine putting your arms around him and they'd go like double around him twice? Cause
she's so miming skinny. It.
I'm miming, hugging David. This microphone stand is kind of like David Tennant. I'm giving him a mental hug right now.
Now, you got to play in a couple of Impro shows.
I did.
Over there.
Which was so exciting. Deborah had Facebooked me to say that there might be an Impro show I could perform in and gave me the contact details. And when I got back up to Glasgow, I rang the guy and sorted it out. And he said, yep, that'd be great. We're doing a big improvaganza, which was a midnight show, midnight Thursday. And we're getting people from all different troops who were there for the festival to turn up and be in this giant elimination format.
Yep.
And so I had that teed up when I went across to Edinburgh. But then, by chance, on the Monday, I was walking past and I saw the venue for this improvaganza. And I went, oh, I'm going to go in and check out and see if there are any posters or anything like that. And I came out with a big megaphone and a hat, a top hat on, and went, ladies and gentlemen, the Impro Jam is about to begin. And I went, oh, an Impro Jam. Well, I'm here. I've got some time. I've got £8.50. I'm going to buy a ticket and go. And I went downstairs and it turns out these were the same guys. Introduced myself and they said, oh, you're Natalie. Oh, we've got you down to play. I was like, oh, cool. So I saw the show, and then I said after the show, do you need players? And they said, yeah, come along. So I got to play twice on both the Tuesday and the Wednesday in Edinburgh. And the show was called Impro Jam.
Yep.
And the point of it was to get people up from the audience who volunteered by putting their name on a ping pong ball, and if their name got pulled out of a tombola.
Like karaoke.
Yeah. So the idea was is that you only put your name in the tombola if you wanted to get up. So, you know, they wouldn't pick people who weren't actually keen.
Yep.
And so the audience member...
I've done that sort of thing. Like, I find that when you give the audience the opportunity to give you some sort of offer without putting them on the spot, you can often get some really exciting stuff out of them. Like,
yeah.
I like to give out cards and pens at the beginning of shows to get certain offers.
Can I tell you, though, that was something that they were doing at Impro Jam, and it slightly backfired on them.
Ooh.
Because they got a lot of very rude suggestions. They would have a question like, if you could get away with anything in the world, what would you do? And then they would use the different answers as prop lines for scenes. So you'd have one improviser kind of feeding the audience member these lines. So, for example, in a dating game, the improviser would hand the audience member who was playing the guest, hand them these lines and go, okay, these are your questions to ask the potential dates. So in that sense, it worked well, except for when they got all these rude answers, including but not limited to bestiality, doing terrible things into a cup of coffee.
Ejaculating?
Well,
into
I don't,
coffee?
I'm just saying terrible things, Dan. Terrible, terrible things. And so all sorts of
but
things.
But it was what that was.
Sexual acts with creatures other than humans. It really ran the gamut.
We occasionally do the sort of animal sex. Very occasionally that sort of thing turns up on stage in our shows. Usually it's a little bit more subtle, like it's referred to.
We take a Merchant Ivory view of animal sex on stage.
I've only once been really forced into that position where I'm like, here I am, having sex with a sheep.
I think that we as a company, though, have made a conscious effort to weed that out and to ask for our offers in ways that discourages that.
Yeah.
One of the things about having a pen and a paper is that you're anonymous. So your ideas, you can write down whatever. Mm. And then if the audience doesn't really respond to it, you don't have to own up to it. And if they really like the animal sex scene, then you can go, that was my suggestion. And people will go, wow, you're a thinker. you are an original thinker. You know, we all wanted to go there, but you were the one who went with animal sex.
One thing I really liked about it is that when I was doing it, I did it at the Hub, and I said, whatever scene you want to see, write it down on this card and we'll have to do it. And I went, that's it. Even if it's a terrible, terrible idea for a scene, even if it's really gross, we're going to have to deal with it. And it meant that the improvisers would have to somehow work with what they'd been given.
How did it go?
Very well. And we didn't get any really rude stuff.
See, that's the thing. I don't know whether it was just the nature of the people coming along who were going, yeah, let's really push.
Douches.
No, not really. I think most of the audience who were going along were other performers or other people who were there for the festival. So they either had experience with performing or they were actors or they were musicians or whatever. So they had experience being on stage.
Yep.
And consequently, they, you know, were just really putting the improvisers into it and going, yeah, let's go with the really nasty suggestions. But what that meant was they didn't have any sort of way to back up those scenes when they didn't have enough lines that were non-filthy. So they ended up, on one night, the director of the show ended up dropping a couple of games because he just didn't have any clean lines to go with, which sort of amazed me because it was a very structured show. Having an audience member up meant that you weren't really improvising. You were just sort of there to support the audience member and work off them. But they were the star and you didn't really interact with the other improvisers as much. It was more just working around the audience member. And
that puts a lot of pressure on you as the performer.
Well, it was.
You've got to make sure everything's running on track.
It was easier than I had imagined that such a format would be because I think so many people in the audience were actors, performers, and they were up for it. So they were quite they were quite keen to get on stage and be the centre of attention and say things.
One nice thing about doing one of these shows at a comedy festival, I guess, like a whole bunch of the punters are actually have their own shows.
Exactly. So they're all keen to get up and star again. So, yeah, I think it was a nice way of doing it. They were able to get up feeling very safe in the knowledge that whatever they said would be fine and, you know, they would have improvisers to help them and support them and give them lines to say and things like that. But they had no way of when they didn't have lines that they'd pre-prepared or had from the audience. So they just cancelled a couple of games. They just kind of skipped ahead, which was sad in a way because I would have thought you'd be able to stand up and go, okay, well, we need something and we need this and just grab offers in the sort of normal ask the audience way. But I guess they set up a lot of scenes where they required written answers on
I wonder
on
what paper. Sort of impro history the people running it had, because you'd think that if they'd done a normal impro show, they'd be all up for doing that sort of thing.
I think they were probably constrained by the structure and the focus on the audience member. So they really wanted to. They didn't know if audience members would be able to automatically get up and just make things up or respond to an audience one-off suggestion. So they really wanted to give them some structure and some fallback suggestions. So it wasn't a particularly.
Because the last thing you want to do is make an audience member feel like a dick.
Exactly. And it was all about making them look good, making them feel safe, and giving them their moment.
Mm.
Which was a really nice way to do it. And everyone sort of who came up on stage left really feeling, hey, yeah, I was funny and I rock. And so that's to the credit of the other improvisers who gave that support. And really the only way that you could display some of your improv skill, I think, was in playing characters. And that's where I thought that, you know, character work is so important because a lot of times the scenes were structured in such a way that you were given, you know, who you are. Okay, you're an employee, you're the boss, you're here to do this, you're here to do this. So you were kind of given the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way you could make it distinctive and put some of your own into it was to play characters. So in one scene, the audience member was a fireman and I was a bingo caller and we'd met on the internet and this was our first real life date.
Oh, yeah.
So I played a very lascivious older woman, and because they'd given me the job of a bingo caller, I threw in a lot of jokes about... I understood where the level of the audience was, so I threw in a lot of, do you know, I'm very experienced with balls, I like to get my hands on the balls, that sort of thing. He was a fireman. I said, do you like to Do you like to grip
the hose? So you were very careful not to aim over their heads.
Yeah, I was very subtle, you know, within reason. And one time he the audience member set me up the most brilliant line. I couldn't believe how perfect it worked out. Because the director had the role of occasionally just telling the audience member what to say if they wanted to move the scene along, which was good. And the director said to the audience member, comment on the settings, you know, the table settings or your environment. And he said, this is a lovely table they've laid out for us, isn't it? And I said, oh, yes, Jeremy. And I certainly hope it won't be the only thing getting laid sometime this evening. And the audience just cracked up. And I was like, score! I got a laugh! And, yeah, so that was nice. It was a nice setup. And so I played a bit of a character. And then because I... one of the things that I did was to try to, if I didn't know what was going on, I just blamed the fact that I was Australian and had no idea. So I would say, I'm sorry, I'm from Australia. I don't know what I'm doing. And that way, you know, you play low status and, you know, say, look, it's not you, it's me. I'm totally wrong. I'm so sorry. And the audience doesn't mind you for that because you've gone, yeah, mea culpa, I'm Australian, sorry. And at one point in that same scene, when I said, oh, I've got something here for you, and the audience member who'd obviously picked up that I was Australian from this earlier went, is it an Aborigine? And I just looked at him and went, and completely, it threw me. And I sort of dropped character and went, no, it's not an Aborigine. And it's typical bloody British, isn't it? Just jump to the racial stereotype. What's going on? And he went, no, I meant a boomerang. Oh, that's much better. And so it kind of became this sort of weird farcical thing for a moment.
A meta scene.
Yeah, before I kind of just jumped him as a sexually lascivious older woman. And then the scene finished. So
I like the notion of bringing home that ball, that big metal cage that you wind around that's full of ping pong balls, bringing that back into the bedroom.
Yeah.
Just number 16.
Ooh.
The reverse cowgirl.
How did I know you were going to say the number reverse six. Cowgirl? That's a get this special. They always talked about the reverse
there
cowgirl.
There are a couple of really nice, odd sexual maneuvers that are nice to pull out for comedy purposes. I like the, what is it, the Dirty Sanchez?
Oh.
Or the Rusty Trombone. I heard a radio personality talking about bets, and he said, oh, but you know, you're the sort of person who'll felch on a bet. And then someone else was like, you're not really supposed to say that on air. And he's like, I meant to say welch on a bet.
What's welch?
Welch is to not go through with the bet.
Oh, right. Okay. Slip of the tongue.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
Oh, I'm a comic genius. Deary me. Speaking of felching, though,
and this is why we can't have 8-year-olds in the audience.
Apologies to everyone under age who's listening. Then the third night I was in Edinburgh, though, speaking of felching and all things sexually deviant, my final night was this improvaganza.
Go on.
Which is, well, I was so excited about improvaganza because the impro jams had been fun and I'd really enjoyed playing them, but I hadn't really got a chance to do improv with other improvisers. And I was really looking forward to the improvaganza for that purpose. It was all improvisers. It was a midnight show. It was going to be, you know, cutting loose, you know, a bit of swearing, a bit of naughtiness, I thought, but hey, let's go for it. I got chucked out on the first elimination, which was after two games.
Yeah, and because you weren't very good?
Well, yes, but also because...
Because you're Australian, possibly.
Probably because I was Australian. I think it was more the fact that I'd been in two scenes that were quite unremarkable, and while I had attempted to make them slightly more remarkable, I failed. The first scene wasn't too bad. It was the subtitles, and I played a Mexican woman. And
well, so there's two people on stage speaking in gibberish,
yes,
and then two people doing the voices.
Translation.
Yep, the translation.
So I really was quite proud of my Spanish accent, and I threw in a lot of jokes like, mi casa del burrito, and which is my house is a burrito. I threw in lots of references to taco.
Wow, I didn't know you could speak nonsense in another language.
Well, because it was Mexican, I thought, well, there's nothing to say. They said it's a Mexican movie. So I went, well, there's no point doing gibberish that sounds like, Chong Hiwatang Chang Chang Wong, you know, if you approximate the sound of the language, it gives it a bit more authenticity. Even if
I'm dreadful, I get about three words in and then it ends up all being French.
Yeah. But that's fine if you're doing a French scene. You just have
Not good for Russian.
No, no.
Or
that's where
Indian
you bring in Wade.
Or Chinese.
We all have our specialty languages, right? We all have our specialty accents, so.
There was a wonderful scene I saw Wade do back at the Hotel LA where he got on stage and had to do a scene about a Japanese game show. And there was some rookie, some guy who hadn't played much, and he got up on stage and had both of them realize, had been talking to each other previously and knew that they knew a bit of Japanese. So they got up and started speaking Japanese to each other, but it was all sort of mock Japanese. Mm. So neither of them could speak properly, but they both sold this terrible Japanese so well. And it was such a delightful scene. I think Godzilla ended it. Like, turned up in the end.
Well, as he should.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where just even little things that you do in impro can really add authenticity to a scene. So you don't have to know Spanish to kind of know what a Spanish accent sounds like. If you've listened to Antonio Banderas talk or Penelope Cruz and just listen to the ways their voice lilts and that sort of thing. So that's why I was trying to approximate with Mexican. I had the image of Salma Hayek in my head.
Nice.
And so I was thinking, Mexican woman, she's got to be feisty. And I was playing a guitar to start the scene, and it started quite well because I sort of made the sounds of the guitar, and then the guy translating just did the same thing. So I went da-da-ding-ding-ding, and he went da-da-ding-ding-ding. So that got a big laugh. That was cute. So then the whole scene was me accusing my husband of an affair, and making lots of hand gestures of, you know, that's it, I'm leaving you, and making, I think it was quite obvious that I was going to leave.
Only 70% of communication is verbal.
Exactly. So I left.
The rest of it is sexual.
The reverse cowgirl. the husband, the guy playing the husband who was an American, was on his knees kind of pleading. So there was a nice sort of picture there happening, I thought. And I went to leave, but there was nowhere for me to get off stage. And I was hemmed in by the musician on one side. So I couldn't actually leave the stage. And the guy kept talking to me. So I had to turn around and kind of go, well, we need to end this scene. So I know I'll just kind of take him back. And then, you know, mi amore forever, or something like that. And shoved his face into my boobs. Got a laugh for the boobs.
I wish I had boobs.
Instant gold. And then use them wisely.
Yeah.
That's what I've learned in my 8 years of impro. Because I overdid it for a while there. It's still my shtick.
Yeah.
Hopefully there are more women coming into impro. We can stop doing the boob jokes because there's going to be other
or just spread
jokes.
It around a bit.
Or
more.
Yeah, everyone gets to have some.
See,
boobs.
That's the thing. If I get a female performer on stage and I shove her head into my crotch, that's an immediate dismissal. That's like, I'm sorry, you're going to have to take 6 months off impro then by force.
We're going to pay for you to have some counselling. So that was the first scene, the Mexican scene, and it ended reasonably well. It was audience clapometer. I think we got a score of 4 out of 5, so that was doing quite well. Mm-hmm. The second scene I did was a postcard scene, which is where one person describes their holiday while clicking up slides, you know, and explaining the photos, and the other players
pose as the photos. I've seen a lot of those games fail.
And this one was no exception.
Excellent.
Because the guy who sort of got picked out to go, right, it's your holiday, either he didn't know the game or he was a bit unsteady with the game, because the way I would play the game is, even if I, you know, the common sense is to sort of start by introducing yourself or saying, guys, thanks for coming to my slide night.
Mm-hmm.
I'll click the first slide, giving your other players sort of an indication of, you know, when to start. So I was just standing there like a rabbit in the headlights waiting for some sort of, do I pose now, do I not? Before I had the chance to, the guy started talking, and then this American guy who was playing, who was a good player and quite a charismatic player, but he did talk like this all of the time. He had a voice that just was like this. Everything he said, every last syllable was enunciated.
Must be interesting to date that guy.
Hey, I bought you some flowers. I'm really excellent.
Yeah. This has been nice. Yeah.
How about we try the reverse cowgirl?
Look, I'll call you.
I want to do it.
Yeah, look.
I'm taking off my pants now.
I've got a headache.
I'm taking them off.
I've got an early morning tomorrow.
Look at that. Look at that.
Look, I'm just going to cut this off.
So
I'm no unit.
So he was popular with the audience because he was very energetic, and that was a thing that was great about him. But he did have the same voice rhythm the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But he was good in that scene because he just kind of jumped in and gave a pose, which was he lay on the ground and put his feet in the air, and we sort of ended up holding his feet. So the guy turns around and go, oh, and this is my holiday. He was given Brazil. So instead of going, you know, I don't know, I would assume something like beaches or carnival.
Coconuts.
Street crime. Favelas.
City of God.
Incredible Hulk. He went for, this is the funeral I went to. This is the funeral I went to. Which is
big
not...
festivals. Like, the funerals are big festival things there, don't they?
I guess so, but
maybe that's where he came from.
Maybe, but he just saw, my thing was he just saw the American on the ground and us standing over him and went, it's a funeral. That's not a bad choice to make.
Yep.
But he didn't bring anything about Brazil into it at all. So it was only when they called for the second photo and I went, I've got to do something different. So I jumped out, boobs again.
Yeah.
You know, and adopted like a showgirl position. And then
sorry,
that,
I heard the words boobs jumped
yeah,
out.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I may have got it in the wrong order.
I jumped out.
Okay.
Adopted a showgirl position.
Yep.
That was quite boob heavy.
Yeah.
In that I, you know, went like, I can't, obviously, how can I describe this?
Doing.
Chest forward, you know, hands back.
I think the best word for describing it is a wooga.
Well, I did get in a nipple tassel joke because he described me as some exotic dancer. I was like, well, finally, mm-hmm. got something Brazilian. And then it became about how the exotic dancer was at the funeral or something like that. So, and it was really quite poor. It was just not particularly entertaining. And also, the other thing that was interesting about the improviganza is that they didn't end scenes. Players didn't end scenes. It was all up to the directors. And
you'd want to hope your director knows what he's doing.
Well, this is the thing. They did, and they ended scenes at good points. But there were good points earlier where I would have thought, you know, natural endings had occurred.
Mm.
And I guess maybe because we at Impro Mafia have been short form workers for so long that once our scenes start to get into the sort of 4 or 5 minute mark, we really make attempts to wrap them up and to get them over with. And even if they're 2 minutes in and they're sucking, we just go, let's end it and move on. This one, maybe because it was Maestro and they wanted to give everyone a chance,
yeah.
they just let them go. And there was a... I know, Dan, that you're a big fan of a scene called Stunt Doubles. I know that it's one of your personal favourites and that you insist on playing it every single time you play impro. I know it is one of your favourites.
I don't really, what's the word, like Stunt Doubles at all.
Well, you would have been enamoured. You would have been overjoyed to watch the Stunt Double scene at Edinburgh that I watched that was 8 or 9 minutes long. Yeah, it
went,
and it had the American guy in it, and the two guys, I think the two English guys who were playing the stunt doubles, and their physicality was excellent, and I think that was the thing that kept the scene going.
Yep.
They did all of the stunt double things in slow motion, which I realise is actually a brilliant thing that we don't do in Impro Mafia, which may account for why our stunt doubles suck, because we come on and go, quick, you know, oh my god, there's pirates coming, and all of a sudden two people rush on and go, chink, 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 and then rush off again. If the stuff was done in slow motion, it would
that
probably
could be a lot
make
better.
Them a lot better. So that was a really great thing I took away.
Yep.
And their physicality was excellent. Every blow was felt, you know, and every fall was done brilliantly in slow motion. But the scene itself just went on and on and on, and it was just about someone like applying to be a flatmate, and it just kept going and going and going. Mm. So they didn't players didn't end scenes; they just kept going until the directors called them down. The other thing that was my main eye-opener at this Edinburgh show was it was a midnight show and I was prepared for some bawdiness and some raunchiness, but there were some scenes that got really full-on and there were some things said that were really very misogynistic and I was sitting in the audience going,
did it involve raping little kids?
No, no, but there was one scene, a dating scene.
Yeah.
And the setup for the scene was that the person, the guy who owned the flat, is bringing back a date for the first time. But he has a parrot, who's another improviser, and the parrot has a tendency to drop very inappropriate comments at inappropriate times.
Yep.
Thus, it's a kind of, by that setup, you know it's a stake-raising exercise. You start sort of nervous and shy. The parrot starts saying inappropriate things like he likes to wear women's underwear or he...
He ups the stakes, basically.
Ups the stakes. And so you get this sort of build of tension. And they'd played it in the Impro Jam, and it worked quite well with the audience member as the person whose flat it was.
Oh, yep.
The improviser, who was given the task of being the date, bringing home the date for the first time, dragged the player playing the date on stage by the arm, slapped them across the face, and said, well, the rehypnol worked. Am I allowed to say the F word? I'll just say, are we going to fuck now or what? And
charming.
And I just went...
Funny.
And the thing is, the guy playing the parrot, I could see in his face... Him thinking, well, I don't know where to go from here.
There's not a, like, to escalate from there.
Yeah.
He hasn't given him a lot of wiggle room.
He'd come in at level 9 out of 10, you know. There wasn't a lot of room for this guy to go. The American guy who was playing the date, you know, the sort of scared young woman, was trying to play a scene. And this guy playing the flat owner was just saying this, when are we going to fuck? We're going to fuck now. And it was really quite confronting. And to the point where I felt awkward. Someone put it to me later, another player put it to me that it may have been nerves and that may have been his response to nerves.
Oh, yes. Well we had a player doing that. That was always Josh. Did you ever play with Josh?
Yeah, I think I did once or twice.
Yeah, Josh
American?
Josh is from America. And he was actually a really talented... Look, he was quite new to it, but he did some really nice impro. But when he panicked, his response was to do something really disgusting. So suddenly there were scenes about eating vomit. He was the guy who made sure that the scene about having sex with sheep involved me miming having sex with sheep.
Oh, I see.
And we all have our things we do when we panic.
Yeah. So I think maybe that's true for some people. This guy was a British guy, and he just made me... I felt really awkward. A lot of the audience were laughing. It was 1 a.m. by this point, and, you know, a lot of people had a lot to drink. In Edinburgh, you take your drinks into the theatre with you. That's why so many people go, because they can drink while watching the show. They don't have to finish their drinks. They just walk in with their beers.
Scottish.
Well, a lot of people take 2 beers in, and they finish one, and then they start on the other one, you know, over the course of an hour show. So... maybe that was just nerves, but I know I just felt a bit awkward, and I thought I felt some people in the audience going, okay, that's weird. I mentioned that the parrot guy seemed unable to find somewhere to raise the stakes, but he managed to slip in something that got turned into, I think the date started talking about he had a picture of the elephant, an elephant on his wall. The guy playing the main character got up and went, yes, okay, I admit it. I fucked an elephant up the ass.
Oh, dear.
So that's where it went to after Rohypnol. It went to elephants.
Elephant fucking.
Yeah. And I apologise to anyone listening for my swearing. I do apologise. But I did mention I swore.
Hmm.
We'll have to put an M rating on this podcast for strong language.
They're all labelled explicit.
Oh, are they? Oh, okay. Cool. Fuck. Ah! I just knocked over my water bottle.
Vodka. She knocked over her vodka bottle.
I knocked over my vodka bottle. You shut up, Dan. Are you looking at me funny? Are you?
That'll be the Christmas show. We'll just get you and Luke and me and we'll have some shots. And then record the podcast.
I'm so drunk.
Oh, this is what I think about our competitors. Yeah.
And this is why I think that you'll never be as good a player as me. And I'll tell you why.
I think I just threw up in your microphone. Let me tell you about about Impro Gladiators. Those fucking cock munchers don't know shit about Impro. They think they're so good with their talent and their venue and their ability to get paid for what they do. They're fucked. And so is Peter Haywood.
Hi, Peter. I've been listening to you, Peter. Call me. No, don't call me. Will he listen? Do you think he'll listen?
He'll listen.
Do you think Peter Haywood will be listening right now?
I think he's gay.
Really?
Yep, I'm going to out him right now.
Is that because he was touching you on the penis when you did your podcast with him?
It was awesome.
So he won't call me then unless I, you know, get a transplant. Or...
you're pretty mannish.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan. I've just been talking about how all of my Edinburgh improv involved getting my boobs out. Not out, obviously. Mm. You know, out with
miming
clothes
them.
On. No, just ensuring they were in good vision of the audience. In good vision? In good view of the audience. Hi, everyone. I'm an improviser. I'm not very good, but I have these.
What the? A wooga!
Well, that was my decision that I made. I made a choice. I said, this is a midnight show. I'm a female improviser. They're probably going to go with the chicks aren't funny thing, which is not true. I was just being nervous, so I thought I'd, you know, boob it up. Can we cut that bit? That made no sense.
No. Fuck it. I'm keeping it all.
The thing is about Edinburgh that was really expired in Edinburgh, was that so many females had shows that were just so brilliant, and that's what has really inspired me, and I just want to be like, do one-woman shows now, and not necessarily be a comedian, but just write a show that's kind of funny and put it on, because that's what these women were doing, and they're sort of the shows that you don't just go and do 5 minutes, 10 minutes at a comedy club and talk about how big your dick is. These women were talking about, one woman was talking about rediscovering her joy of knowledge and of science and of learning. Another woman called Nina Conti was a ventriloquist, is talking, you know, was kind of a, called Evolution, which is all about her monkey telling her how, you know, he represents the repressed part of her brain. And just so clever with brilliant monkey props and all this sort of stuff. And Deborah's show is all about how to make yourself attractive to the opposite sex. And just amazing stuff that female performers were doing. It was just incredible to watch. And I think that's really inspiring to go, comedy is not just guys getting up and talking for 10 minutes about their dicks and about, isn't it crap when women do this? So that was really inspiring. People are probably listening going, oh, yeah, female women in comedy, they're not funny. But these chicks were. They were really funny. And the thing is, I've seen some female comedians and I haven't liked them. Mm-hmm. But I realise it's not because they're female. It's just because I don't like their style of comedy. There are loads of women out there who are doing great stuff that's so funny, that's really my sense of humour.
Uh-huh.
So that was brilliant to see and to witness.
So you reckon you could do your own one-woman show?
I reckon I could.
Could you do an impro one-woman show?
It would probably involve elements of impro in the sense that, like, what Deborah does, which is so brilliant, is that she talks to the audience and she really gets them on side. She doesn't aggressively go after them. She doesn't put them down. She doesn't demean them. She just asks them questions and gets them involved and makes them feel warm and feel safe. And so by talking to her, you don't feel like you're being picked on by a comedian. You're just taking part in the show. And she's so personable in doing that. And that's her brilliance. I mean, she writes a great show as well that's very funny. But the fact that she's able to just involve the audience and just get them keen and get them taking part and get them involved, it's just brilliant to watch. She's an expert at it. So I don't know if I'd have that straight away. I, you know, would need to develop that.
And she has awesome boobs. Awooga!
Awooga!
And time! You have been listening to Natalie Bohensky. Natalie has a blog at girlclumsy.com.
Read it!
I'm Dan Beeston. I've got a site at invisiblespiders.com, but you're sick of hearing how it's going to get updated one day, and it never is. For news about Impro in Brisbane, go to impromafia.com. Thanks to David Beachy for our theme music. Hosting for End Time is dotingly provided by CivicNet Web Design.
Sorry for cutting you off.
No, that's okay.
But we just hit the hour mark.
Oh, shit, sorry.
But a lot of it is terrible.
Oh, okay.
Or at least libelous.